This answer is quoted from memory, but it substantially relates Ford's answer. There was silence in the courtroom. The questioning attorney's jaw dropped down, his eyes opened wide. The judge leaned forward from the bench and stared at Ford. Many of the jury awoke and looked around as if they had heard an explosion, which they actually had. A prominent clergyman who was present in the courtroom at the time said later that the scene reminded him of that which must have existed when Jesus Christ was on trial before Pontius Pilate just after he had given his famous reply to Pilate's question, "What is truth?" In the vernacular of the day, Ford's reply knocked the questioner cold. Up to the time of that reply, the lawyer had been enjoying considerable fun at what he believed to be Ford's expense by adroitly displaying his general knowledge and comparing it with what he inferred to be Ford's ignorance as to many events and subjects. That answer spoiled the lawyer's fun. It also proved once more to all who had the intelligence to accept the proof that true education means mind development, not merely the gathering and classifying of knowledge. Ford could not, in all probability, have named the capitals of all the states of the United States, but he could have, and in fact had, gathered the capital with which to turn many wheels within every state in the Union. Education, let us not forget this, consists of the power with which to get everything one needs when he needs it without violating the rights of others. Ford comes well within that definition, as the foregoing incident shows.
As the example of Henry Ford demonstrates, power is organized knowledge, expressed through intelligent efforts. Let us consider how a mastermind facilitates the exercise of power. The current era has been called the information age, due in large part to the ease with which information is transferred through computers and modems, at speeds, and in such volume that were unthinkable even a generation ago. But information is not organized knowledge. In fact, one of the chief complaints of many people is that they have far more information at their disposal than they know what to do with. A few minutes surfing the internet in search of the answer to a particular question can produce a deluge of conflicting, ambiguous information that does nothing to increase one's knowledge. Thousands of facts may have been gathered, but an understanding of those facts, including which are significant and which are not, is necessary before they can be considered knowledge. Even such knowledge is not power. It is only potential power, the material out of which real power may be developed. The key to unlocking all this potential power is properly organized effort. Suppose you had collected the name and address of every CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Having this information represents a potential power, the ability to contact these men and women. Such power might or might not be useful to you. If you were attempting to sell a small starter home in need of much repair, you would be targeting a very unlikely group of buyers. If, on the other hand, you were selling a luxurious estate with state-of-the-art security and communications capability, this group of people would likely be more interested. Clearly, the knowledge you acquire must be suited to your task. If you were indeed selling such an estate, and you never attempted to contact these CEOs, however, you would not be exercising the potential power of your knowledge, simply because you made no effort. If you sent each of them a box of chocolates and some balloons with a handwritten note about your property, you would make an effort, but it would not be appropriate. However, if you printed a handsome brochure featuring photographs of the estate and outlining all its unique qualities, you would be applying your knowledge much more usefully, giving you the power to attract the attention of your potential buyers. So far, the selling of this estate has involved at least three separate tasks. First, the collection of the names of potential buyers. Second, the creation of an appropriate selling tool. And third, its distribution to your potential buyers. Supposing you interested some of these people, you would also need someone to show the property and eventually to negotiate the terms of the deal. This means at least five different tasks, all requiring different kinds of knowledge. You could work to educate yourself for each of these jobs, or you could create a mastermind. You could begin enlisting a direct mail specialist to collect the list of names. That person could also contribute ideas for the brochure, which would be designed by a graphic artist familiar with all the necessary steps for production. You would handle showing the estate and selling it to your prospective buyers, and the fine points of the deal could be hammered out by an attorney. You would all be united behind a common purpose, dedicating your special skills to the task of making the sale. But who would have been truly responsible for making the sale happen? You. For it was you who assembled the team that got the job done.
The uses of learning. There are many learned people who could easily entangle Ford, theoretically, with a maze of questions none of which he personally could answer. But Ford could turn right around and wage a battle in industry or finance that would exterminate those same men with all of their knowledge and all of their wisdom. Ford could not go into his chemical laboratory and separate water into its component atoms of hydrogen and oxygen and then recombine these atoms in their former order, but he knows how to surround himself with chemists who can do this for him if he wants it done. The person who can intelligently use the knowledge possessed by another is as much or more a person of education as the one who merely has the knowledge but does not know what to do with it. The president of a well-known college inherited a large tract of very poor land. This land had no timber of commercial value, no minerals, or other valuable appurtenances. Therefore, it was nothing but a source of expense to him, for he had to pay taxes on it. The state built a highway through the land. An uneducated man who was driving his automobile over this road observed that this poor land was on top of a mountain that commanded a wonderful view for many miles in all directions. He, the ignorant one, also observed that the land was covered with a growth of small pines and other saplings. He bought 50 acres of the land for $10 an acre. Near the public highway, he built a unique log house to which he attached a large dining room. Near the house, he put in a gasoline filling station. He built a dozen single-room log houses along the road. These he rented out to tourists at $3 a night each. The dining room, gasoline filling station, and log houses brought him a net income of $15,000 the first year. The next year he extended his plan by adding 50 more log houses of 3 rooms each, which he now rents out as summer country homes to people in a nearby city at a rental of $150 each for the season. The building material cost him nothing, for it grew on his land in abundance, that same land which the college president believed to be worthless. Moreover, the unique and unusual appearance of the log bungalows served as an advertisement of the plan, whereas many would have considered it a real calamity had they been compelled to build out of such crude materials. Less than 5 miles from the location of these log houses, this same man purchased an old, worked-out farm of 150 acres for $25 an acre, a price which the seller believed to be extremely high. By building a dam 100 feet in length, the purchaser of this old farm turned a stream of water into a lake that covered 15 acres of the land, stocked the lake with fish, then sold the farm off in building lots to people who wanted summering places around the lake. The total profit realized from this simple transaction was more than $25,000, and the time required for its consummation was 1 summer. Yet this man of vision and imagination was not educated in the orthodox meaning of that term. Let us keep in mind the fact that it is through these simple illustrations of the use of organized knowledge that one may become educated and powerful. In speaking of the transaction here related, the college president who sold the 50 acres of worthless land for $500 said, "Just think of it. That man, whom most of us might call ignorant, mixed his ignorance with 50 acres of worthless land and made the combination yield more yearly than I earn from 5 years of application of so-called education." There is an opportunity, if not scores of them, in every state in America to make use of the idea here described. From now on, make it your business to study the lay of all land you see that is similar to that described in this lesson, and you may find a suitable place for developing a similar money-making enterprise. The automobile has caused a great system of public highways to be built throughout the United States. On practically every one of these highways, there is a suitable spot for a cabin city for tourists which can be turned into a regular money-making mint by the person with the imagination and self-confidence to do it.
If you think that Hill's example of starting what we now know as a motel is out of date and no longer applicable, you are not hearing the ideas for the words. As this edition is being edited, Hill's advice is almost 75 years old. Yet one of the most exciting new business ventures of this era might well have been inspired by that out-of-date story. Jeff Bezos did exactly what Hill suggested. He looked for a highway on which to set up a business. When he found the right place, he opened a bookstore. The highway that Bezos found was the information highway, and the bookstore was Amazon.com. Sometimes the innovation requires specialized education or technical expertise, but just as often the business itself is not especially new. The innovation is in finding the right highway. Laura Brody is another example of someone whose inspiration made her greater than the so-called experts. The author of several cookbooks, she noticed that many people were buying and enjoying the bread machines that have lately become so popular, but she also noticed that they were not fully satisfied with the bread they were making. Her first right move was to write a new cookbook for bread machines, which was an instant success. Then, she took her good idea even further. Huge corporations were manufacturing these machines. Other huge corporations were making mixes to use in them. But Brody alone realized that these appliances were different enough from traditional techniques that the old methods weren't enough. What bread machine bakers needed were additives, simple, natural ingredients that professional bakeries used all the time. So she created a line of dough enhancers that could be added to any bread machine recipe, creating a better, more tasty loaf. Soon, her bread machine magic was in grocery stores and cooks' catalogs around the country, making home bakers happier, and Brody a wealthy and popular entrepreneur. The experts who had been involved in creating these machines and the flour companies that thought to profit from their popularity had looked right past a tremendous opportunity that one woman who organized her knowledge profited from. In the mid-1970s, computers were used by big businesses. They were giant, complicated machines, too expensive for anyone else to afford. Or such was the conventional wisdom at companies like IBM. Steve Jobs and Stephen Wozniak thought differently. In a garage in California, they built a small computer that could fit on a desktop. The company they founded was called Apple. The Apple computer created a revolution in the computer industry and made multimillionaires of Jobs and Wozniak because they organized their knowledge in a way that no one had before. Ray Kroc saw that people wanted fast food, and he created McDonald's. Frederick W. Smith saw that people wanted safe, reliable delivery, and created FedEx. Bill Bowerman saw people jogging, and created Nike to make the shoes for the new fad. There are similar opportunities everywhere, in every walk of life, in every area of human endeavor to achieve success. This course was designed to help you see these opportunities and to inform you how to make the most of them after you discover them. What it cannot do is give you the benefit of real education, of creating an understanding based on your own efforts. You must resolve to take the ideas that you absorb here and apply them in all your efforts. As this course proceeds, you will learn more about the mastermind as well as all the other significant principles you must apply. You will begin to see how they all fit together into a harmonious whole, a manner of acting and thinking that takes best advantage of the way the world operates. But only through applying each of these principles will you truly understand how to integrate them. Remember, your own actions will educate you in the law of success. There are opportunities to make money all around you. This course was designed to help you see these opportunities and to inform you how to make the most of them after you discover them.
Who can profit most by the law of success philosophy? Transportation officials who want a better spirit of cooperation between their employees and the public they serve. Salaried people who wish to increase their earning power and market their services to better advantage. Salespeople who wish to become masters in their chosen field. The law of success philosophy covers every known law of selling and includes many features not included in any other course. Industrial plant managers who understand the value of greater harmony among their employees. Employees who wish to establish records of efficiency that will lead to more responsible positions with greater pay. Merchants who wish to extend their business by adding new customers. The Law of Success philosophy will help any merchant increase business by teaching how to make a walking advertisement of every customer who comes into the store. Sales agents or managers who wish to increase the selling power of their sales force. A large part of the Law of Success course was developed from the life, work, and experience of the greatest automobile salesman, and it is therefore of unusual help to the sales manager who is directing the efforts of a sales force. Life insurance agents who wish to add new policyholders and increase the insurance on present policyholders. One life insurance salesman in Ohio sold a $50,000 policy to one of the officials of the Central Steel Company as the result of but one reading of the lesson on profiting by failures. This same salesman has become one of the star men of the New York Life Insurance Company's staff as the result of his training in the 17 Laws of Success. School teachers who wish to advance to the top in their present occupation or who are looking for an opportunity to enter the field of business as a life work. Students, both college and high school, who are undecided as to what field of endeavor they wish to enter as a life work. The Law of Success course covers a complete personal analysis service that helps the student of the philosophy to determine the work for which he or she is best fitted. Bankers who wish to extend their business through better and more courteous methods of serving their clients. Mid-level managers who are ambitious to prepare themselves for executive positions in the field of banking or in some commercial or industrial field. Physicians and dentists who wish to extend their practice without violating the ethics of their profession by direct advertising. A prominent physician has said that the Law of Success course is worth $1,000 to any professional man or woman whose professional ethics prevent direct advertising. Entrepreneurs and promoters who wish to develop new and heretofore unworked combinations in business or industry. The principle described in this introductory lesson is said to have made a small fortune for a man who used it as the basis of a real estate promotion. Real estate agents who wish new methods for promoting sales. This introductory lesson contains a description of an entirely new real estate promotion plan which is sure to make fortunes for many who will put it to use. This plan may be put into operation in practically every state. Moreover, it may be employed by agents who never promoted an enterprise. Farmers, who wish to discover new methods of marketing their products so as to give them greater net returns, and those who own lands suitable for subdivision promotion under the plan referred to at the end of this introductory lesson. Many farmers have gold mines in the land they own, which is not suitable for cultivation, which could be used for recreation and resort purposes on a highly profitable basis. Entry-level service workers who are looking for a practical plan to promote themselves into higher and better-paying positions. The Law of Success course is said to be the best course ever written on the subject of marketing personal services. Printers who want a larger volume of business and more efficient production as the result of better cooperation among their own employees. Laborers who have the ambition to advance into more responsible positions in work that has greater responsibilities and consequently offers more pay. Lawyers who wish to extend their clientele through dignified, ethical methods which will bring them to the attention, in a favorable way, of a greater number of people who need legal services. Business executives who wish to expand their present business or who wish to handle their present volume with less expense as the result of greater cooperation between their employees. Service industry owners who wish to extend their businesses by teaching their drivers how to serve more courteously and efficiently. Life insurance general agents who wish bigger and more efficient sales organizations. Chain store managers who want a greater volume of business as the result of more efficient individual sales efforts. Married people who are unhappy and therefore unsuccessful because of lack of harmony and cooperation in the home. To all described in the foregoing classification, the Law of Success philosophy offers both definite and speedy aid.
Robert Louis Stevenson wrote, "An aim in life is the only fortune worth finding, and it is not to be found in foreign lands, but in the heart itself."
Summary: The Mastermind. The main purpose of this introductory lesson is to state some of the principles upon which the course is founded. These principles are more accurately described, and the student is taught in a very definite manner how to apply them in the individual lessons of the course. All new ideas, and especially those of an abstract nature, find lodgment in the human mind only after much repetition. A well-known truth that accounts for the restatement in this summary of the principle known as the mastermind. A mastermind may be developed by a friendly alliance in a spirit of harmony of purpose between two or more minds. This is an appropriate place at which to explain that out of every alliance of minds, whether in a spirit of harmony or not, there is developed another mind which affects all participating in the alliance. No two or more minds ever met without creating, out of the contact, another mind, but this creation is not always a mastermind. There may be, and altogether too often there is, developed out of the meeting of two or more minds, a negative power which is just the opposite of a mastermind. There are certain minds which, as has been stated throughout this lesson, cannot be made to blend in a spirit of harmony. This principle has its analogy in chemistry. For example, the chemical formula H2O, meaning the combining of two atoms of hydrogen with one atom of oxygen, changes these two elements into water. One atom of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen will not produce water. Moreover, they cannot be made to associate themselves in harmony. There are many known elements which, when combined, are immediately transformed from harmless into deadly poisonous substances. Stated differently, many well-known poisonous elements are neutralized and rendered harmless when combined with certain other elements. Just as the combining of certain elements changes their entire nature, the combining of certain minds changes the nature of those minds, producing either a certain degree of what has been called a mastermind or its opposite, which is highly destructive. Some minds will not be harmonized and cannot be blended into a mastermind, a fact that all leaders will do well to remember. It is the leader's responsibility so to group his subordinates that those who have been placed at the most strategic points in his organization are individuals whose minds can and will be blended in a spirit of friendliness and harmony. Ability so to bring people together is the chief outstanding quality of leadership. In Lesson 2 of this course, you will discover that this ability was the main source of both the power and fortune accumulated by the late Andrew Carnegie. Knowing nothing whatsoever of the technical end of the steel business, Carnegie so combined and grouped the people of which his mastermind was composed that he built the most successful steel industry known to the world during his lifetime. Henry Ford's gigantic success may be traced to the successful application of this self-same principle. With all the self-reliance a man could have, Ford nevertheless did not depend upon himself for the knowledge necessary in the successful development of his industries. Like Carnegie, he surrounded himself with people who supplied the knowledge which he himself did not and could not possess. Moreover, Ford picked men who could and did harmonize in group effort. The most effective alliances which have resulted in the creation of the principle known as the mastermind have been those developed out of the blending of the minds of men and women. The reason for this is the fact that the minds of male and female will more readily blend in harmony than will the minds of only one gender. Also, the added stimulus of sexual contact often enters into the development of a mastermind between a man and a woman. The road to success may be and generally is obstructed by many influences that must be removed before the goal can be reached. One of the most detrimental of these obstacles is that of unfortunate alliance with minds which do not harmonize. In such cases, the alliance must be broken, or the end is sure to be defeat and failure. Those who master the six basic fears, one of which is the fear of criticism, will have no hesitancy in taking what may seem to the more convention-bound type of mind to be drastic action when they find themselves circumscribed and bound down by antagonistic alliances, no matter of what nature or with whom they may be. It is a million times better to meet and face criticism than to be dragged down to failure and oblivion on account of alliances which are not harmonious, whether the alliances be of a business or social nature. While it is true that some minds will not blend in a spirit of harmony and cannot be forced or induced to do so because of the chemical nature of the individual's brains, Do not be too ready to charge the other party to your alliance with all the responsibility of lack of harmony. Remember, the trouble may be with your own brain. Remember also that a mind that cannot and will not harmonize with one person or persons may harmonize perfectly with other types of minds. Discovery of this truth has resulted in radical changes in methods of hiring. It is no longer customary to discharge an employee who does not fit in the position for which he or she was originally hired. The discriminating leader endeavors to place such a person in some other position where, it has been proved more than once, such individuals may become valuable. You should be sure that the principle described as the mastermind is thoroughly understood before proceeding with the remaining lessons of the course. The reason for this is the fact that practically the entire course is closely associated with this law of mind operation. If you are not sure that you understand this law, analyze the record of anyone who has accumulated a great fortune, and you will find that they have, either consciously or unconsciously, employed the mastermind principle. You cannot spend too much time in serious thought and contemplation in connection with the law of the mastermind, for the reason that when you have mastered this law and have learned how to apply it, new worlds of opportunity will open to you.
If you cannot do great things yourself, remember that you may do small things in a great way.
Any sales organization may make effective use of the law of the mastermind by grouping the sales force in groups of two or more people who will ally themselves in a spirit of friendly cooperation and apply this law as suggested in this lesson. An agent for a well-known make of automobile, who employs a sales force of 12, has grouped the organization in six groups of two each, with the object of applying the law of the mastermind, with the result that all the salespeople have established new high sales records. This same organization has created what it calls the one-a-week club, meaning that each person belonging to the club has averaged the sale of one car a week since the club was organized. The results of this effort have been surprising to all. Each member of the club was provided with a list of 100 prospective purchasers of automobiles. Each salesperson sends one postcard a week to each of his 100 prospective purchasers and makes personal calls on at least 10 of these each day. Each card is confined to the description of but one advantage of the automobile and asks for a personal interview. Interviews have increased rapidly, as have also sales. The agent who employs the sales force has offered an extra cash bonus to anyone who earns the right to membership in the one-a-week club by averaging one car a week. The plan has injected new vitality into the entire organization. Moreover, the results of the plan are showing in the weekly sales record. A similar plan could be adopted very effectively by life insurance agencies. Any enterprising general agent might easily double or even triple the volume of business through the use of this plan. Practically no changes whatsoever would need to be made in the method of use of the plan. The club might be called the Policy a Week Club, meaning that each member pledges to sell at least one policy of an agreed minimum amount each week. The student of this course, who has mastered the second lesson and understands how to apply the fundamentals of that lesson, a definite chief aim, will be able to make much more effective use of the plan here described. It is not suggested or intended that anyone undertake to apply the principles of this lesson, which is merely an introductory lesson, until he or she has mastered at least the next five lessons of the Law of Success course. The automobile sales organization referred to in this summary meets at luncheon once a week. 1 hour and a half are devoted to luncheon and to the discussion of ways and means of applying the principles of this course. This gives each individual member an opportunity to profit by the ideas of all the other members of the organization. Two tables are set for the luncheon. At one table, all who have earned the right to membership in the one-a-week club are seated. At the other table, which is serviced with tinware instead of china, those who did not earn the right to membership in the club are seated. These, needless to say, become the object of considerable good-natured chiding from the more fortunate members seated at the other table. It is possible to make an almost endless variety of adaptations of this plan. The justification for its use is that it pays. It pays not only the leader or manager of the organization, but every member of the sales force as well. This plan has been briefly described for the purpose of showing you how to make practical application of the principles outlined in this course. The final acid test of any theory or rule or principle is that it will actually work. The law of the mastermind has been proved sound because it works. If you understand this law, you are now ready to proceed with Lesson 2, in which you will be further and much more deeply initiated in the application of the principles described in this introductory lesson.
Henry Van Dyke wrote, "The best rosebush, after all, is not that which has the fewest thorns, but that which bears the finest roses."
Lesson 2. Your definite chief aim. You can do it if you believe you can. You are at the beginning of a course of philosophy which, for the first time in the history of the world, has been organized from the known factors which have been used and must always be used by successful people. Literary style has been completely subordinated for the sake of stating the principles and laws included in this course in such a manner that they may be quickly and easily assimilated by people in every walk of life. Some of the principles described in the course are familiar to all who will listen to the course. Others are here stated for the first time. It should be kept in mind, from the first lesson to the last, that the value of the philosophy lies entirely in the thought stimuli it will produce in the mind of the listener, and not merely in the lessons themselves. Stated in another way, this course is intended as a mind stimulant that will cause you to organize and direct to a definite end the forces of your mind, thus harnessing the stupendous power which most people waste in purposeless thought. Singleness of purpose is essential for success, no matter what may be one's idea of the definition of success. Yet singleness of purpose is a quality which may and generally does call for thought on many allied subjects. I traveled a long distance to watch Jack Dempsey train for an oncoming battle. It was observed that he did not rely entirely upon one form of exercise, but resorted to many forms. The punching bag helped him develop one set of muscles, and also trained his eye to be quick. The dumbbells trained still another set of muscles. Running developed the muscles of his legs and hips. A well-balanced food ration supplied the materials needed for building muscle without fat. Proper sleep, relaxation, and rest habits provided still other qualities that he must have in order to win. You should be engaged in the business of training for success in the battle of life. To win, there are many factors which must have attention. A well-organized, alert, and energetic mind is produced by various and sundry stimuli, all of which are plainly described in these lessons. It should be remembered, however, that the mind requires for its development a variety of exercise, just as the physical body, to be properly developed, calls for many forms of systematic exercise. Horses are trained to certain gates by trainers who jump them over hurdles to help them develop the desired steps through habit and repetition. The human mind must be trained in a similar manner, by a variety of thought-inspiring stimuli. You will observe, before you have gone very far into this philosophy, that the absorption of these lessons will induce a flow of thoughts covering a wide range of subjects. For this reason, you should listen to the course with a notebook and pencil in hand and follow the practice of recording these thoughts or ideas as they come into the mind. By following this suggestion, you will have a collection of ideas, by the time this course has been heard two or three times, sufficient to transform your entire life plan. By following this practice, it will be noticed very soon that the mind has become like a magnet, in that it will attract useful ideas right out of thin air, to use the words of a noted scientist who has experimented with this principle for a great number of years.
In the time since Hill wrote these words, considerable research has been done on creativity, intuition, and various thinking styles and techniques. In almost all cases, books written on these subjects tend to support Hill's theory that the act of writing down what you think or dream prompts the human mind to make leaps of insight and spontaneously create original ideas. This in turn has prompted a whole subset of books about what is now termed journaling. If you wish to explore the possibilities further, you will find the following books of interest. The Intuitive Edge by Philip Goldberg. The Right Brain Experience by Marilise Denick. Creative Dreaming by Patricia Garfield. And Writing the Natural Way by Gabriel Rico. Books on methods of thinking include numerous works by Tony Buzan and an extensive collection of influential bestsellers written by Edward de Bono. Books on journaling include Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg, At a Journal Workshop by Ira Progoff, and The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron.
You will do yourself a great injustice if you undertake this course with even a remote feeling that you do not stand in need of more knowledge than you now possess. In truth, no human knows enough about any worthwhile subject to entitle him to feel that he has the last word on that subject. In the long, hard task of trying to wipe out some of my own ignorance and make way for some of the useful truths of life, I have often seen, in my imagination, the great marker who stands at the gateway entrance of life and writes, "Poor fool," on the brow of those who believe they are wise, and "Poor sinner," on the brow of those who believe they are saints. Which, translated into workaday language, means that none of us know very much, and by the very nature of our being can never know as much as we need to know in order to live sanely and enjoy life while we live. Humility is a forerunner of success. Until we become humble in our own hearts, we are not apt to profit greatly by the experiences and thoughts of others. Sounds like a preachment on morality? Well, what if it does? Even sermons, as dry and lacking in interest as they generally are, may be beneficial if they serve to reflect the shadow of our real selves so that we may get an approximate idea of our smallness and superficiality. Success in life is largely predicated upon who we know. The best place to study the human animal is in your own mind, by taking as accurate an inventory as possible of yourself. When you know yourself thoroughly, if you ever do, you will also know much about others. To know others, not as they seem to be, but as they really are, study them thoroughly. The posture of the body and the way they walk. The tone of the voice, its quality, pitch, volume. The eyes, whether shifty or direct. The use of words, their trend, nature, and quality. Through these open windows, you may literally walk right into a person's soul and take a look at the real human being. Going a step further, if you would know people, study them. When angry, when in love, when money is involved, when eating alone and unobserved as they believe, when writing, when in trouble, when joyful and triumphant, when downcast and defeated, when facing catastrophe of a hazardous nature, when trying to make a good impression on others, when informed of another's misfortune, when informed of another's good fortune, when losing in any sort of game of sport, when winning at sport, when alone, in a meditative mood. Before you can know people as they really are, you must observe them in all the foregoing moods and perhaps more, which is practically the equivalent of saying that you have no right to judge others at sight. Appearances count. There can be no doubt of that, but appearances are often deceiving. This course has been so designed that the student who masters it may take inventory of himself and of others by other than snap judgment methods. When you master this philosophy, you will be able to look through the outer crust of personal adornment, clothes, so-called culture and the like, and down deep into the heart. This is a very broad promise. It would not have been made if I had not known from years of experimentation and analysis that the promise can be met.
No person is educated who has not at least a speaking acquaintance with the law of compensation, as it is described by Emerson.
Some who have examined the manuscripts of this course have asked why it was not called a course in master salesmanship. The answer is that the word salesmanship is commonly associated with the marketing of goods or services, and it would therefore narrow down and circumscribe the real nature of this course. It is true that this is a course in master salesmanship, providing one takes a deeper-than-the-average view of the meaning of salesmanship. This philosophy is intended to enable those who master it to sell their way through life successfully with the minimum amount of resistance and friction. Such a course, therefore, must help the student organize and make use of much truth that is overlooked by the majority of people who go through life as mediocrities. Not all people are so constituted that they wish to know the truth about all matters vitally affecting life. One of the great surprises I met with in connection with my research is that so few people are willing to hear the truth when it shows up their own weaknesses. We prefer illusions to realities. New truths, if accepted at all, are taken with the proverbial grain of salt. Some of us demand more than a mere pinch of salt. We demand enough to pickle new ideas so they become useless. For these reasons, the introductory lesson of this course, and this lesson as well, cover subjects intended to pave the way for new ideas so those ideas will not be too severe a shock to the mind of the listener. The thought I want to get across has been quite plainly stated by the editor of The American Magazine in an editorial that appeared in a recent issue in the following words. Quote, "On a recent rainy night, Carl Lohmann, the reindeer king of Alaska, told me a true story. It is stuck in my crop ever since, and now I am going to pass it along. A certain Greenland Eskimo, said Lohmann, was taken on one of the American North Polar expeditions a number of years ago. Later, as a reward for faithful service, he was brought to New York City for a short visit. At all the miracles of sight and sound, he was filled with a most amazed wonder. When he returned to his native village, he told stories of buildings that rose into the very face of the sky, of streetcars which he described as houses that moved along the trail with people living in them as they moved, of mammoth bridges, artificial lights, and all the other dazzling concomitants of the metropolis. His people looked at him coldly and walked away, and forthwith throughout the whole village he was dubbed Sagluk, meaning the liar, and this name he carried in shame to his grave. Long before his death, his original name was entirely forgotten. When Knut Rasmussen made his trip from Greenland to Alaska, he was accompanied by a Greenland Eskimo named Mitek, a name that means eider duck. Mitek visited Copenhagen and New York, where he saw many things for the first time and was greatly impressed. Later, upon his return to Greenland, he recalled the tragedy of Sagluk and decided that it would not be wise to tell the truth. Instead, he would narrate stories that his people could grasp and thus save his reputation. So he told them how he and Dr. Rasmussen maintained a kayak on the banks of a great river, the Hudson, and how each morning they paddled out for their hunting. Ducks, geese, and seals were to be had aplenty, and they enjoyed the visit immensely. Mitek, in the eyes of his countrymen, is a very honest man. His neighbors treat him with rare respect. The road of the truth-teller has always been rocky. Socrates sipping the hemlock, Christ crucified, Stephen stoned, Bruno burned at the stake, Galileo terrified into retraction of his starry truths. Forever could one follow that bloody trail through the pages of history. Something in human nature makes us resent the impact of new ideas. Unquote. We all hate to be disturbed in the beliefs and prejudices that have been handed down with the family furniture. At maturity, too many of us go into hibernation and live off the fat of ancient fetishes. If a new idea invades our den, we rise up snarling from our winter sleep. The Eskimos, at least, had some excuse. They were unable to visualize the startling pictures drawn by Sagluk. Their simple lives had been too long circumscribed by the brooding Arctic night. Open your mind. But there is no adequate reason why the average person should ever close his mind to fresh slants on life. He does just the same. Nothing is more tragic or more common than mental inertia. For every 10 people who are physically lazy, there are 10,000 with stagnant minds. And stagnant minds are the breeding places of fear. An old farmer up in Vermont always used to wind up his prayers with this plea, "Oh God, give me an open mind." If more people followed his example, they might escape being hamstrung by prejudices. And what a pleasant place to live in the world would be.
By and large, there is no such thing as something for nothing. In the long run, you get exactly that for which you pay, whether you are buying an automobile or a loaf of bread.
Every person should make it his or her business to gather new ideas from sources other than the environment in which he or she daily lives and works. The mind becomes withered, stagnant, narrow, and closed unless it searches for new ideas. The farmer should come to the city quite often and walk among the strange faces and the tall buildings. He will go back to his farm, his mind refreshed, with more courage and greater enthusiasm. City people should take a trip to the country every so often and freshen their minds with sights new and different from those associated with their daily routines. Everyone needs a change of mental environment at regular periods, the same as a change in variety of food are essential. The mind becomes more alert, more elastic, and more ready to work with speed and accuracy after it has been bathed in new ideas outside of one's own field of daily labor. As a student of this course, you will temporarily lay aside the set of ideas with which you perform your daily labors and enter a field of entirely new and, in some instances, heretofore unheard of ideas. Splendid! You will come out at the other end of this course with a new stock of ideas which will make you more efficient, more enthusiastic, and more courageous, no matter in what sort of work you may be engaged. Do not be afraid of new ideas. They may mean to you the difference between success and failure. Some of the ideas introduced in this course will require no further explanation or proof of their soundness because they are familiar to practically everyone. Other ideas here introduced are new, and for that very reason, many students of this philosophy may hesitate to accept them as sound. I have thoroughly tested every principle described in this course, and the majority of the principles covered have been tested by scores of scientists and others who were quite capable of distinguishing between the merely theoretic and the practical. For these reasons, all principles here covered are known to be workable in the exact manner claimed for them. However, no listener of this program is asked to accept any statement made in these lessons without having first satisfied himself or herself by tests, experiments, and analysis that the statement is sound. The major evil you are requested to avoid is that of forming opinions without definite facts as the basis, which brings to mind Herbert Spencer's famous admonition in these words, "There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all argument, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. This principle is contempt prior to examination." Unquote. It may be well to bear this principle in mind when you come to study the law of the mastermind described in these lessons. This law embodies an entirely new principle of mind operation, and for this reason alone, it will be difficult for you to accept it as sound until after you have experimented with it. When the fact is considered, however, that the law of the mastermind is believed to be the real basis of most of the achievements of those who are considered geniuses, this law takes on an aspect which calls for more than snap judgment opinions. It is believed by many scientists whose opinions on this subject have been given me that the law of the mastermind is the basis of practically all of the more important achievements resulting from group or cooperative effort. The late Dr. Alexander Graham Bell said that he believed the law of the mastermind, as it has been described in this philosophy, was not only sound, but that all the higher institutions of learning would soon be teaching that law as a part of their courses in psychology. Charles P. Steinmetz said that he had experimented with the law and had arrived at the same conclusion as that stated in these lessons long before he talked to me about the subject. Luther Burbank and John Burroughs made similar statements. Edison was never questioned on the subject, but other statements of his indicated that he would endorse the law as being a possibility, if not, in fact, a reality. Dr. Elmer Gates endorsed the law when I spoke to him some years ago. Dr. Gates is a scientist of the highest order, ranking along with Steinmetz, Edison, and Bell. I have talked to scores of intelligent businessmen who, while they were not scientists, admitted they believed in the soundness of the law of the mastermind. It is hardly excusable, therefore, for those of less ability to judge such matters, to form opinions as to this law without serious, systematic investigation.
The mastermind is a mental state that is developed through the harmonious cooperation of two or more people who ally themselves for the purpose of accomplishing any given task. The mastermind harnesses the dedicated effort of a group of people, pools their resources, both tangible and intangible, and creates a new whole that is greater than the sum of its parts. A mastermind operates, or should operate, among the members of the board of directors for huge international corporations. It operates among a team of engineers designing a new car. It operates in the production of a movie, the conduct of a political campaign, or the launch of a new advertising strategy. A mastermind occurs when a church begins a fundraising program for a new building, when a group of neighbors organizes to increase the safety of their community, and when a young couple commits to a lifetime of marriage. A mastermind is powerful and versatile. Its strength and broad usefulness arise from its connection to the fundamental principles around which our universe is organized.
Let me lay before you a brief outline of what this lesson is and what it is intended to do for you. Having prepared myself for the practice of law, I will offer this introduction as a statement of my case. The evidence with which to back up my case will be presented in the 17 lessons of which the course is composed. The facts out of which this course has been prepared have been gathered through more than 25 years of business and professional experience, and my only explanation of the rather free use of the personal pronoun throughout this course is that I am writing from first-hand experience. Before this course on the Law of Success was published, the manuscripts were submitted to two prominent universities with the request that they be read by competent professors with the object of eliminating or correcting any statements that appeared to be unsound from an economic viewpoint. This request was complied with, and the manuscripts were carefully examined, with the result that not a single change was made, with the exception of one or two slight changes in wording. One of the professors who examined the manuscripts expressed himself in part as follows. "It is a tragedy that every boy and girl who enters high school is not efficiently drilled on the 17 major parts of your course in the Law of Success. It is regrettable that the great university with which I am connected and every other university does not include your course as a part of its curriculum." Unquote. Inasmuch as this course is intended as a map or blueprint that will guide you in the attainment of that coveted goal called success, may it not be well here to define success? Success is the development of the power with which to get whatever one wants in life without interfering with the rights of others. I would lay particular stress upon the word power because it is inseparably related to success. We are living in a world enduring an age of intense competition, and the law of the survival of the fittest is everywhere in evidence. Because of these facts, all who would enjoy enduring success must go about its attainment through the use of power. And what is power? Power is organized energy or effort. This course is properly called the Law of Success for the reason that it teaches how one may organize facts and knowledge and the faculties of one's mind into a unit of power. This course brings you a definite promise, namely, that through its mastery and application, you can get whatever you want with but two qualifying words, within reason. This qualification takes into consideration your education, your wisdom or your lack of it, your physical endurance, your temperament, and all of the other qualities mentioned in the 17 lessons of this course as being the factors most essential in the attainment of success. Without a single exception, those who have attained unusual success have done so either consciously or unconsciously through the aid of all or a portion of the 17 major factors of which this course is compiled. If you doubt this statement, then master these 17 lessons so you can go about the analysis with reasonable accuracy and analyze such men as Carnegie, Rockefeller, Hill, Harriman, Ford, and others of this type who have accumulated great fortunes of material wealth, and you will see that they understood and applied the principle of organized effort which runs like a golden cord of indisputable evidence throughout this course.
Anyone who has ever participated in a quality circle at work knows how business employs the mastermind. The assembly teams that have replaced assembly lines at the most modern and efficient factories reflect the same use of the mastermind. Stephen Covey, the author of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, speaks of the mastermind when he writes of the interdependent person. "As an interdependent person," he says, "I have access to the vast resources and potential of other human beings. Dennis Conner, the 2-time winner of Sailing's America's Cup, has a philosophy of teamwork that is a perfect expression of the mastermind, emphasizing the power of commitment and dedication to a task. Read his book, The Art of Winning, for a vivid explanation of how Conner used the mastermind to create a winning team. From restaurant kitchens to football teams, from factories to scientific laboratories, the mastermind harnesses the potential power of a group of minds focused on a goal. Can you afford to ignore this valuable resource in your quest for success?
What do you mean by success? Nearly 20 years ago, I interviewed Mr. Carnegie for the purpose of writing a story about him. During the interview, I asked him to what he attributed his success. With a merry little twinkle in his eyes, he said, "Young man, before I answer your question, will you please define your term success?" After waiting until he saw that I was somewhat embarrassed by his request, he continued, "By success, you have reference to my money, have you not?" I assured him that money was the term by which most people measured success, and he said, "Oh, well, if you wish to know how I got my money, if that is what you call success, I will answer your question by saying that we have a mastermind here in our business, and that mind is made up of more than a score of men who constitute my personal staff of superintendents and managers and accountants and chemists and other necessary types. No one person in this group is the mastermind of which I speak, but the sum total of the minds in the group, coordinated, organized, and directed to a definite end in a spirit of harmonious cooperation, is the power that got my money for me. No two minds in the group are exactly alike, but each man in the group does the thing that he is supposed to do, and he does it better than any other person in the world could do it." Unquote. Then and there, the seed out of which this course has been developed was sown in my mind. But that seed did not take root or germinate until later. This interview marked the beginning of years of research which led finally to the discovery of the principle of psychology described in the introductory lesson as the mastermind. I heard all that Mr. Carnegie said, but it took knowledge gained from many years of subsequent contact with the business world to enable me to assimilate that which he said and clearly grasp and understand the principle back of it, which was nothing more nor less than the principle of organized effort upon which this course on the law of success is founded. Carnegie's group of men constituted a mastermind, and that mind was so well organized, so well coordinated, so powerful, that it could have accumulated millions of dollars from Mr. Carnegie in practically any sort of endeavor of a commercial or industrial nature. The steel business, in which that mind was engaged, was but an incident in connection with the accumulation of the Carnegie wealth. The same wealth could have been accumulated had the mastermind been directed in the coal business, or the banking business, or the grocery business, for the reason that back of the mind was power, that sort of power which you may have when you shall have organized the faculties of your own mind and allied yourself with other well-organized minds for the attainment of a definite chief aim in life. A careful checkup with several of Mr. Carnegie's former business associates, which was made after this course was begun, proves conclusively not only that there is such a law as that which has been called the mastermind, but that this law was the chief source of Mr. Carnegie's success. Perhaps no one was ever associated with Mr. Carnegie who knew him better than did Mr. C. M. Schwab. In the following words, Mr. Schwab has very accurately described that subtle something in Mr. Carnegie's personality which enabled him to rise to such stupendous heights. Quote, "I never knew a man with so much imagination, lively intelligence, and instinctive comprehension. You sensed that he probed your thoughts and took stock of everything that you had ever done or might do. He seemed to catch at your next word before it was spoken. The play of his mind was dazzling, and his habit of close observation gave him a store of knowledge about innumerable matters. But his outstanding quality, from so rich an endowment, was the power of inspiring other men. Confidence radiated from him. You might be doubtful about something and discuss the matter with Mr. Carnegie. In a flash, he would make you see that it was right and then absolutely believe it. Or he might settle your doubts by pointing out its weaknesses. This quality of attracting others, then spurring them on, arose from his own strength. The results of his leadership were remarkable. Never before in the history of industry, I imagine, was there a man who, without understanding his business in its working details, making no pretense of technical knowledge concerning steel or engineering, was yet able to build up such an enterprise. Unquote. Mr. Carnegie's ability to inspire others rested on something deeper than any faculty of judgment. In the last sentence, Mr. Schwab has conveyed a thought which corroborates the theory of the mastermind to which I attributed the chief source of Mr. Carnegie's power. Mr. Schwab has also confirmed the statement that Mr. Carnegie could have succeeded as well in any other business as he did in the steel business. It is obvious that his success was due to his understanding of his own mind and the minds of other men, and not to mere knowledge of the steel business itself. This thought is most consoling to those who have not yet attained outstanding success, for it shows that success is solely a matter of correctly applying laws and principles which are available to all, and these laws, let us not forget, are fully described in the 17 lessons of this course. Mr. Carnegie learned how to apply the law of the mastermind. This enabled him to organize the faculties of his own mind and the faculties of other men's minds and coordinate the whole behind a definite chief aim.
If you can run a losing race without blaming your loss on someone else, you have bright prospects of success further down the road in life.
Every strategist, whether in business or war or industry or other callings, understands the value of organized, coordinated effort. Every military strategist understands the value of sowing seeds of dissension in the ranks of the opposing forces, because this breaks up the power of coordination back of the opposition. During World War I, and in every war since, much was heard about the effects of propaganda, and it seems not an exaggeration to say that the disorganizing forces of propaganda were much more destructive than were all the guns and explosives. One of the most important turning points of the First World War came when the Allied armies were placed under the direction of the French Marshal Ferdinand Foch. There are well-informed military historians who claim that this was the move that spelled doom for the opposing armies. Any modern railroad bridge is an excellent example of the value of organized effort, because it demonstrates quite simply and clearly how thousands of tons of weight may be borne by a comparatively small group of steel bars and beams so arranged that the weight is spread over the entire group. There was a man who had 7 sons who were always quarreling among themselves. One day he called them together and informed them that he wished to demonstrate just what their lack of cooperative effort meant. He had prepared a bundle of 7 sticks that he had carefully tied together. One by one, he asked his sons to take the bundle and break it. Each son tried, but in vain. Then he cut the strings and handed one of the sticks to each of his sons and asked him to break it over his knee. After the sticks had all been broken with ease, he said, "When you boys work together in a spirit of harmony, you resemble the bundle of sticks, and no one can defeat you. But when you quarrel amongst yourselves, anyone can defeat you one at a time." Unquote. There is a worthwhile lesson in this story of the man and his 7 quarrelsome sons, and it may be applied to the people of a community, the employees and employers in a given place of employment, or to the state and nation in which we live. Organized effort may be made a power, but it may also be a dangerous power unless guided with intelligence, which is the chief reason why the 16th lesson of this course is devoted largely to describing how to direct the power of organized effort so that it will lead to success. That sort of success which is founded upon truth and justice and fairness that leads to ultimate happiness. One of the outstanding tragedies of this age of struggle and money madness is the fact that so few people are engaged in the effort which they like best. One of the objects of this course is to help each listener find his or her particular niche in the world's work where both material prosperity and happiness in abundance may be found. To accomplish this purpose, the various lessons of this course are skillfully designed to help you take inventory and find out what latent ability and hidden forces lie sleeping within you. This entire course is intended as a stimulus with which to enable you to see yourself and your hidden forces as they are, and to awaken in you the ambition and the vision and the determination to cause you to go forth and claim that which is rightfully yours. Less than 30 years ago, a man was working in the same shop with Henry Ford, doing practically the same sort of work that he was doing. It has been said that this man was really a more competent workman in that particular sort of work than Ford. Today, this man is still engaged in the same sort of work at wages of less than $100 a week, while Mr. Ford is the world's richest man. What outstanding difference is there between these two men which has so widely separated them in terms of material wealth? Just this. Ford understood and applied the principle of organized effort, while the other man did not. In the little city of Shelby, Ohio, this principle of organized effort was applied for the purpose of bringing about a closer alliance between the churches and the business houses of a community. The clergymen and businessmen formed an alliance, with the result that practically every church in the city was squarely back of every businessman, and every businessman is squarely back of every church. The effect was the strengthening of the churches and the business houses to such an extent that it has been said that it would be practically impossible for any individual member of either class to fail in his calling. The others who belong to the alliance will permit no such failures. Here is an example of what may happen when groups form an alliance for the purpose of placing the combined power of the group back of each individual. The alliance has brought both material and moral advantages to the city of Shelby, such as are enjoyed by but few other cities of its size in America. The plan has worked so effectively and so satisfactorily that a movement is now underway to extend it into other cities throughout America.
E. Colin Lindsay was a shoe salesman for the Belk Brothers store in Charlotte, North Carolina. There were many other clerks in that store, but Lindsay had the idea of proposing a new store in cooperation with the Belk family. 40 years later, he headed the 35-store chain of Belk Lindsay department stores in the South, while the other salespeople he worked with still wondered what had happened. All that happened was that Lindsay applied organized effort, and the others did not. Jean Nidetch was one of millions of overweight people in America during the 1960s. She knew many other people who were in a similar position, but Nidetch realized how powerful it would be to bring those people together, to inspire each other, to share experiences in losing weight, and so she founded Weight Watchers. From a first meeting with just 50 people, Weight Watchers grew into an organization of more than 1 million members because Nidetch understood the importance of organized effort in helping others.